Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A few weeks ago, I was dining with some out-of-town visitors at an al fresco venue along High Street in Clintonville, and out of seemingly nowhere, a white male about 30 years old sauntered up to our table and started yelling about white supremacy and white power. He held up his right hand in what looked like a Nazi salute. We were stunned at first. Then one of my friends told the guy to get lost. In not so many words, the troublemaker continued to rant as he passed, and he turned around and started to verbally attack another diner behind us, identifying him as Jewish and spewing all manner of anti-Semitic tropes at him and us when we tried to defend him. My friend continued to stand up to the verbal assaults, but mostly we were all stunned. And the truth is, we didn't know what to do. And the fact that hate speech is on the uptick, according to the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations, suggests we need to talk about how to respond, how to protect others and ourselves from that kind of violence. There's a long history of hate, after all, and we should know something by now about how to counteract it. John Esposito is a professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He is founding director of the Al-Walid Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding and the Bridge Initiatives, Protecting Pluralism, Ending Islamophobia in the Walsh School of Foreign Service. Welcome.
Thank you.
So hate speech and that kind of rhetoric and that kind of behavior, it's not new. What do we know about this particular brand of intolerance and hatred, kind of that street bully side of it?
Well, I think that, you know, it's important to realize that we've gotten to a point where, I mean, wherever Americans stand politically on things, they know that we're in a very divided country. And for many of us who grew up with the idea that you had the Statue of Liberty, you know, welcoming, you know, bring me, you're tired, you're poor, and we're from ethnic backgrounds, et cetera. The whole idea was that things were going to become more diverse, more pluralistic. In fact, the push has been back the other way. So white supremacists are significant. You were quite correct in talking about the FBI and also Homeland Security, really saying that the major threat we have is actually domestic now. And the white supremacists, you know, play to the idea, whether it's in the United States or it's in Europe, in many European countries, to the idea that, you know, people of color, people of different religions, et cetera, really don't belong here. And you know, some of that goes back to several decades ago, when, in fact, let's say at the end of the 20th century, very often there was a tendency to see America as a country of Protestants. And then suddenly it was Catholics and Jews added on. But now we're a country of so many different faiths and so many different different approaches.
You know, someone said to me after that, and I've been talking about it, obviously, and thinking a lot about it, said, well, the guy's just a nutbag. You know, you just have to ignore him. And I thought, well, he's a very well-versed. I mean, he had a litany of attacks at the tip of his tongue. It was as if he'd been practicing.
Well, I think that exists. I mean, I've had this experience for quite a few years. When I first got into the field in the late 20th century, there was no interest in Islam or in world religions, that is religions other than Christianity and Judaism. And I taught the other religions. But post the Iranian Revolution and then moving into today, in fact, what you wind up with is people will get up in an audience and they're geared. They've gotten their talking points. It's not as if they're all very creative. It's what they read and what they see. And they literally, for many of them, they sort of memorize this and they quote things out of context, whether it's from the Bible or it's, you know, from whatever context they want. And it can be very rough. And your average American in a restaurant when this happens doesn't know what the hell to do. You know, I mean, it's they're not geared to handle the situation.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the fact that hate speech is on the uptick. That's according to the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Council on American Islamic Relations and Homeland Security, as my guest just noted. And this suggests we need to talk about how to respond and how to protect others and ourselves from that kind of violence. There's a long history of hate. We're talking about that right now with John Esposito. He's a professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. Coming up later, if you have a question or comment, want to share your own experience and how you responded in a hopefully, I don't know what to say, productive way, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's an escalation now, John Esposito. Is there a tipping point you're looking for? Are you concerned about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you tend to see this kind of ebb and flow. But what we're seeing is that it's emerging in some places even more. You look at countries like Sweden, where you would never think that there would be an issue. Or if you look at the situation, if you're dealing with Muslims, you look at the problem of the Uyghurs in China. You look at the situation in Myanmar, the situation of Muslims and Christians in India. And in the U.S., you look at political candidates. And at times, some of our political candidates, with a kind of send them all back. The whole idea of the Muslim ban, etc. On the other hand, I must say that we see a lot of constructive things happening. You go back to the Muslim ban and when it was announced, and you had a flood of people going to airports to respond, of all kinds of different backgrounds, religious backgrounds, political backgrounds, etc. Responding in a very constructive kind of way. I think that that's a positive point, but I think that we need to be concerned. How many synagogues have to be bombed? How many mosques have to be bombed? How many Christian churches have to be bombed before we really realize this is not just a small little group in terms of its power? I mean, look at what happened on January 6th. And many Americans that were actually involved in it would be people that normally you wouldn't have thought would be there, ex-military, ex-police, etc. So we're going through, I think, in the U.S., a crisis. And it'll be a difficult time for minorities.
We've seen in the past, obviously, where this kind of hatred can lead, the devastating effects it can have. There's a lot of dehumanization going on here right now. I mean, right? Is that it's sort of like just it feels like you're cut off at the knees when people attack you in this way.
Yeah. I mean, it's you realize that for people who buy into this kind of worldview, they are so committed that when you deal with them, you realize they're 180 degrees different from where you're coming. And so you actually can get very, as I said, you can be very thrown by the kind of hatred and also accusations come out. A major player with this, by the way, is social media. We have websites on social media that have very innocuous names, but in fact, actually support this kind of divisiveness in our society.
It's like a propagation of the propaganda on steroids.
Yes. I think we fail to see, because many people aren't aware of it, we're talking about, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars that go into supporting this kind of rhetoric in the media and particularly in social media. So that you are pulling in very wide audiences, and yet the titles can have titles like family security. Sounds very innocuous, again, we have not really figured out a way to address it effectively.
Why don't we learn from history?
Yeah, well, my wife always has, talks about that quote, those who don't are condemned. And you are right. I mean, it's sometimes when you hear people talking, it's as if they don't even know their own history. So, for example, if you're dealing with people in religious traditions are very transformative for people's lives. But also, almost all of the major world religions have been used and distorted to legitimate conquest, violence, etc. And unless one really has a sense of history, what people remember is, for example, if you're dealing in the religious sphere, they will talk about another faith and say, well, I see these actions taking place, you know, and then you wind up saying, well, what about the Crusades? How do you think the people on the other side of the Crusades felt? Or you can go into this in many ways. And I see a big change. When I look at my students at Georgetown, I've been there since 1993. In recent years, many of them come and have been exposed in high school to world history courses or world religion courses. And so their ability to deal with other cultures is actually quite remarkable compared to, let's say, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So I think that's very much there. And we have more teachers who are now equipped with these kids in world history or world religion courses to really give them a sense of pluralism and help them also, for many of them, understand that many of them came from minority traditions themselves.
There's a distinction between Islamophobia and anti-Muslim and anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, right? I mean, but are those just distinctions without a difference at this point, where they're being conflated and anyway, and who's to say?
Well, I think if you look at, again, white supremacist language, you will see that many of these groups touch on religions and races, you know, and so there's a common, almost, it seems like a common discourse, you know, that's there. So there's a good chance that somebody who is anti-Muslim will also be anti-Semitic and vice versa, or anti-Sikh. You know, we've had situations where Sikhs have been killed because people saw them as Muslims, but it's also in the back of their mind, it's a sense that they're very different than we are. You know, we somehow belong to a white nation. I remember after 9/11, the day after, in the New York Times, they had a picture of a gas station and somebody saying, you know, send them all back where they came from. Yeah. And I was moved as an Italian American because the guy had an Italian American name. And I thought, your grandfather probably came here. And now think about what you're ready to do vis-a-vis the other.
Is there a moral obligation to do anything?
I think there's a moral obligation. I think it's not only a moral obligation comes from religion. It comes also from what America stands for. We are supposed to be a country that believes in equality, human rights, freedom of religion, and these things are being trampled not only by these white supremacists, but by many candidates who are running for office. All one has to do is follow some of the candidates that are out there and the kind of way in which they mobilize people, talking in terms of the other, these other people, these foreign people. And when they're dealing with Jews and Muslims, you're talking about people that have been here for generations now. But it's still that idea, if you operate from a white supremacist, this is your country. The rest of them are all foreigners.
We are talking about the fact that hate speech is on the uptick. It's according to the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and it suggests we need to talk about how to respond, how to protect others and ourselves from that kind of violence. There's a long history of hate. We're talking about what it has taught us. My guest, John Esposito, is a professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He's founding director of the Al-Walid Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding and the Bridge Initiative, Protecting Pluralism, Ending Islamophobia in the Walsh School of Foreign Service. We are going to have more guests, more talk. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I recently witnessed a prolonged verbal hate speech attack and realized that neither I nor my companions were prepared for how to respond. And that concerned me, given the fact that hate speech is on the increase across the board, according to the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Council on American Islamic Relations, among others. And we're talking today about the phenomenon of hate speech and what it looks like and sounds like and how to respond at the macro and micro levels. Still with us is John Esposito. He's professor of religion and international affairs of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He's also founding director of the Al-Walid Center for Muslim Christian Understanding and the Bridge Initiative, Protecting Pluralism, Ending Islamophobia in the Walsh School of Foreign Service. Amina Barhoumi is acting executive director of CARE Ohio. Amina Barhoumi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I should say welcome back.
Thank you.
And Hillel Skolnick is senior rabbi for the congregation Tifereth Israel. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Is this news? This isn't news to you, right?
It's not news to me at all, sadly. I doubt it's news to too many people at this point because, having had the opportunity, the sad and difficult opportunity to experience moments of hate expressed toward us, we know that it's on the rise. You can see the numbers and reports, as you said, of the Anti-Defamation League and others, but we know that this is happening because we see it happening in our own community and in the country at large.
I mean, I suppose a lot of it's not getting reported.
It's interesting that you say that because I was looking at the numbers from the Anti-Defamation League, and one of the numbers that's listed is the cases of Zoom bombing, which has the number at 78. Zoom bombing comes from when, during the pandemic, we were having services on Zoom, a safe way to gather, and someone would find a way to infiltrate our Zoom room and do something like shout anti-Semitic slurs or put up some sort of Nazi paraphernalia or other kinds of things. We had any number of instances during our time on Zoom when that happened to us. We reported a number of them, but not all of them. And I think that speaks to exactly this situation, because eventually it became a sad routine of everyone learning how to wait for a few minutes while my associate rabbi and I kicked them out of the room and muted everyone, and then we continued on. And we have sadly reached that point in our lives and I think in society where it's just become almost normative. And that in and of itself is the problem.
Amina Barhoumi, you're nodding in, yes, familiar.
Oh, absolutely. I think you're spot on. Unfortunately, this is not new. And I would say for the Muslim or Jewish, you know, communities, this oftentimes is assumed to have begun, say, with Trump running an election and, you know, Trump leaving power, that somehow may mean that the circumstances have changed for individuals who face anti-Muslim discrimination or anti-Semitism. But it is not the case. It's existed before and it continues to exist now. And as numbers are showcasing, in fact, they are on the increase and oftentimes underreported. And we've seen that through the report, through our CARE network, our recent report, not just an uptick, but even a misalignment in terms of how many cases are oftentimes reported by the FBI or other government agencies and how much are reported to our CARE network.
Was that example that I personal experience I cited, is that a reportable incident? Is
Absolutely.
That the kind of thing that they want?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what we encourage people to do. I mean, you talked about an incident like that in terms of what would happen. And you described, you know, what would a person do in this circumstance? And if you're a bystander or if you are somebody who a hate crime or harassment is being perpetrated towards them, there are actionable items you can do. Obviously, in the moment, it's very difficult. But even thinking through and being prepared, unfortunately, for many Muslims and for many individuals in the Jewish community, this is a reality. First and foremost is making sure you could document. So either yourself or others that are watching to make sure that you could take a video. If you cannot safely do so, if you cannot, then, making sure that you document sort of afterwards the incident that had happened. If you're a bystander watching over someone who's a victim, coming up to them and giving them your attention, making sure they are okay, and making sure then after the incident has occurred to move them to a safe space and asking how you could be of support and help, I think speaks volumes and really indicates a red line in terms of not allowing individuals to blatantly speak hatred. Sometimes it's not about what they're saying, because oftentimes it's lies, right?
Oh, yeah, it's untrue. It was all garbage.
It's all just a bunch of garbage and lies. But unfortunately, the audacity to be able to do it, the implications of making it be okay and not have anyone push against it, unfortunately, is part of the problem. And so it's our responsibility to be able to speak up when we see something wrong, and speak up when we see hatred in all of its forms, whether it be individual incidents or even structural, right? Mm. And I'm hoping that we could speak a little bit to that too as well.
Absolutely.
I think we have to report such incidences as what you experienced, because if not, then we don't have an accurate sense of exactly what's taking place in our society. And let it be up to the experts to decide if that counts as an act of hate speech or not. If you feel that someone has said something to you that's inappropriate, we have to report this kind of thing and let someone else be the arbiter or the decision maker of whether or not it counts. And I, of course, completely agree. I think we have to be prepared and be aware of the words that we're going to use in response. But part of the challenge of responding in an instance of someone shouting something at you is that, yes, so much of it is just hateful, slur-filled, slanderous lies, that even if you come back with what you know are hard facts, you're not going to convince a person in that moment. And you have to ask yourself the question, is it worth getting into an argument with this person in whatever situation I am in at the time? Is it going to actually change a person's mind? And I would also add that when a person starts to shout something at you, and not to be an alarmist, you don't know what they have in their pocket.
Correct.
You don't know what their next level of engagement is with you. 1,000% stand up for a person who's being attacked. You don't leave a victim standing by themselves. But when you're making that split second decision of, am I going to interact with a person who is shouting something at me? You also have to think to yourself, well, what are they going to do if I shout back at them?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Hillel Skolnick. He is the senior rabbi for Congregation Tifereth Israel. And also with us, Amina Barhumi. She is acting executive director of CARE Ohio. Also, John Esposito, professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. If you have a question or comment, want to join this conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, John Esposito, the word audacity definitely came to mind for me. And when Amina mentioned that, that was kind of a word it's the audacity of doing this. I mean, we know people feel this way, but the audacity of interrupting somebody, of yelling at them, it looked and sounded and everything unhinged, but nevertheless, it was audacious. And I'm wondering where the permission's coming from. It certainly predates Donald Trump.
I think the permission does come, from media, and particularly social media and the way that it gets used. I've had hate speech. I've had pictures sent to me of a sharpshooter aiming at somebody, and basically it was aiming at my face. This is all out there on social media. And many of these websites promote this kind of outlook. And so they don't see it as audacity. And one of the things I would also add is that there is no way to figure out what the person who's going to be a problem looks like. I can remember having one of my researchers, a very, very bright woman, a Muslim woman who covered, dressed very fashionably, okay, on M Street, in Muslim garb, and having, as she described the person, she said the person was his wife, and the man looked like he was an upscale, the way he was dressed, etc. And then he started screaming things at her, take that off, take that veil off, and just one line after the other. And that's what throws people off too, that as it were, that we, you don't expect it because it can occur any place and the person is not necessarily going to look like they're dangerous before they open their mouth. And then even when they do, as was just said, in the back of your mind, depending on how unhinged they seem, you do have this sense that there can be a violent situation taking place.
It's like a real cognitive dissonance. It's like it's a befuddling and confusing, and it can be even a more micro level. I remember when I first started this job and my boss was introducing me on the radio and kind of interviewing me to introduce me to the audience. And we got one call, and it was a guy asking me if I was Jewish. And at the time, I was so stunned at it that I actually answered his question. Rabbi Skolnick, it was micro, and as soon as it happened, I realized it for what it was, it was very shocking and appalling.
It is shocking and appalling. And yet,
one question.
And yet you overcame it, and here you are, still hosting the show years later. And I think that speaks to the perseverance that we all need to show. I think there's two sides to how do you handle the situation. The first is, how am I mentally preparing myself for the realistic possibility that it could happen? Do I have facts in my back pocket in the event that I get into some sort of appropriate conversation? Do I know where I am? Am I aware of my surroundings in the event that something becomes physical in nature and I have to make a quick escape? Am I with people who I know, who I trust? Do I know where I am? Do I know where I can get help if I need? But I think the response also is to persevere, that these hate-filled moments in life are meant to make us feel afraid and to try to prevent us from getting involved in our communities, of our religious communities, of our secular communities, but specifically in the Muslim and Jewish community. What we need from people is to get involved, that perhaps the best response to a situation like that, of somebody shouting at you at a restaurant or asking you a clear question that comes with all kinds of background, is to then go after you finish whatever activity you're doing and say to yourself, how can I get more educated? How can I get more involved? We have a beautiful tradition in Judaism that the world rests on Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim, on the learning of sacred text, on worship, and on acts of loving kindness. I think the best way to respond to acts of hatred is to learn more about ourselves and about our religions, is to engage in acts of worship, and also to engage in acts of loving kindness. We can show the world that we overcome these moments by continuing to be compassionate and kind people.
I think about what you just said, you know, all the questions about, am I safe? Am I here? Do I know who I can call? All of those kinds of things. And I'm thinking, Amina, that kind of creates a sort of a, and I'm not criticizing or countering it, just like I'm thinking people have to walk around sort of in this high alert.
That's an unfortunate reality.
State of high alert,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. But, here's what I'll say, and this is why we exist as an organization. Unfortunately, intimidation, retaliation, surveillance exists because Islamophobia exists. And so, we certainly will not be intimidated. But I think to your comment about the implicit bias that's oftentimes exists sometimes in a question and how something is framed really speaks to some of that structural racism or structural Islamophobia and anti-Semitism that exists within our institutions. And so combating that, just like you mentioned, Rabbi, is that is how do we mobilize to be able to push back against this structural Islamophobia or anti-Semitism? And so, one of which, Dr. Esposito mentioned media and social media. Mm-hmm. I'd also add to that the narratives and curriculum in classrooms. And the kind of politics and the rhetoric that is is used oftentimes by elected officials or individuals that are running for office. And so really being able to call out on politicians when a wrong is being said, making sure that there's an understanding of pushing back against narratives, even if they exist in the classrooms and the education. So, I mean, I'll give you like a prime example of some of the cases that we get and the complaints that we get. At best, what they look like is putting the burden and the onus on a student to be able to explain themselves and their faith, or to be able to describe geopolitical, make geopolitical analysis on something that even a teacher or an expert wouldn't be able to do. And then at worst, sometimes harassment completely being perpetrated by the teacher, or that complaints that students make to an administration or the teacher are not taken seriously. Or when complaints happen in a workplace for somebody who requests, say, accommodations, and then they are fired from the job, not able to make their livelihood and you know, be able to provide for their families, or as patients in healthcare. So, I mean, the discrimination, the implications of structural Islamophobia really trickle down to everyday individuals who, you know, should be able to live, learn and practice their faith free from any kind of harassment, discrimination, retaliation, and even surveillance.
I would just add that while this is the topic of our conversation today, I think we both know that these kinds of structural challenges that exist within our society are certainly not only against Jews or Muslims.
Correct.
There are many in our world that struggle.
The LGBTQ,
All minority groups, of course. I mean, fascism is on the rise. and these, you know, we're here to talk about two examples of them, but oftentimes they're part of that same wavelength and narrative as Dr. Esposito.
No, I could have filled the room, no question.
But we appreciate that you chose us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking as far as the structural issue goes, John Esposito, and the issue of narratives and curriculum in classrooms, right now they're talking about quote-unquote critical race theory, which has been debunked as a topic in most, in particularly in anything below graduate level law studies. But be that as it may, it's a dog whistle for talking about the history of racism and the history of systemic racism in the United States. But are we just starting with that, and now the next thing it's going to be, well, you got to tell both sides of the story about Nazism in Nazi Germany during World War II, or I mean, is this a slippery slope that we're potentially on?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that, the fact is that people who very often are anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, et cetera, are people who believe that their narrative is the correct narrative. And again, where you see it so clearly is when you see some of the people who are not only running for Congress, but some who are already in and who engage in this rhetoric of hate and marginalization, so that they become part of our system, you know, our legal system. You also have the pressures put on universities. If you speak out on some of these issues, what you can wind up with is that people will say, I'm going to write to your president, your dean, I'm going to get in touch with whomever. And that's a very important way of threatening people. I remember after 9/11, there was an organization called Campus Watch, and they listed academics, you know, in terms of that were dangerous, et cetera. As it turned out, I was in the first category. It was a new thing. I like being first, but I don't know about that. But the reality of it was, in the first category, instead of it just being people who were public academics and public intellectuals, they included graduate students and junior faculty who were teaching courses that they didn't like. And we see that now. That is, other organizations that are far right wind up basically talking about what goes on in our schools. You look at the state of Florida, I'm at this moment, I happen to be here right now, although I live in the Washington area. And in the name of going after critical race theory, they wound up going after books in mathematics. Think about that. Hundreds of books in mathematics to be pulled off. Now, wrap your mind around that. In a country in which we like to feel that we have more and more an educated population, the idea that somebody would think that books of mathematics are somehow a threat. I think that that's where we really are. And that's why organizations like CARE, like ADL and others are so important in being willing to take it on. Because again, I don't think that people realize the kind of pressure that can be made on religious leaders and institutions and on organizations by outsiders who can write messages that, you know, that really make you wonder about, you know, the threat or what can happen in your community. And I think the fact that, again, and I say it simply because it's important for the audience to realize, what backs this up is the FBI, Homeland Security, you know, a variety of organizations that have spoken out about the fact that things have, you know, gotten more, as it were, dangerous.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll get back to it. We are talking about the increase in hate speech and how to defend yourself and how to think about defending society from it as well. If you have a question or comment, we'll get to those. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I recently witnessed a prolonged verbal hate speech attack and realized that neither I nor my companions were prepared for how to respond. And that concerned me, given the fact that hate speech is on the increase across the board. It's according to the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Council on American Islamic Relations. We're talking today about the phenomena of hate speech, what it looks and sounds like, and how to respond at the societal level and at the personal level. Still with us, John Esposito. He's professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. Amina Barhoumi is acting executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Ohio. And Hillel Skolnick is senior rabbi for the congregation Tifereth Israel. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. John Esposito is so when I have an experience like that and somebody's interrupting my dinner and yelling at us and then attacking a neighboring diner and we're going through all of this, is anything being legally violated there, or is that guy perfectly within his rights to mess with us that way?
It's very, very difficult. If the person is not touching you, you know, they can say what they want to say. I happen to have an experience where I was speaking to a group of government officials, but just before it, I received an email in which the person talked about the fact that someone should come in, bitch slap me until my body was bloody, drag me out by my hair into the corridors, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the questions was, is that enough to go to the police or to the FBI? So it's a very, and especially if it's something that occurs and you don't have a video, if somebody doesn't take a video of it.
Yeah.
And there, we do have this notion in the US, which is broader than, let's say, in the UK, with regard to what is regarded as hate speech and what's acceptable. And in our country, it's a very broad kind of notion.
Let's see, Charlie and Powell, you're on the air.
Thanks, Ann, for taking my call. Sure. I just wanted to address the fact that I don't think hate mongers have increased at all. I think that they have been enabled by Donald Trump with his hate speech. I think he's enabled people to come forward, and now it's normalized. And I think that that's why you hear it on the rise, is because the people who used to be quiet about it are now speaking up and saying it out loud. And I know that's scary, but that's my opinion. Thanks.
Thanks, Charlie. Appreciate that. Let's see. Let's get to another call real quick. Brad in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for this show. Sure. I agree with Charlie. How do we respond? I would respond to the guy in the restaurant by saying, why are you so insecure? White people already run the country. There's no danger in that going away. The messaging imbalance is astounding to me. We, the side, the people that believe in truth and freedom and equality and democracy, we need to message better with more frequency. If the right wing, especially the far right, does anything well, it's messaging. They message their hate, they message their prejudice, they message their bigotry, and they use every possible platform as much as possible. Radio, TV, Fox, magazines, public loud rants like you experienced, Ann. Mm-hmm. Social media, my God, social media and the internet. The age-old advice of don't believe everything you read or don't believe everything you hear goes unheeded. And they know it, and they exploit it. Even in our so-called information age, the dissemination of dis and misinformation is worse than ever. It's much worse. We're in the disinformation age, and that movement is winning and exploiting with intent every weakness. How? With repetition, repetition, frequency, using demonstrative anger. People that see somebody demonstrating anger, on some level, they think, oh, they must have a point because they're so angry. Well, it's performative, and I am so tired of it. I want to see the liberal side, the truth-believing side, the democratic side message better. I mean, look where Biden administration is in. What's the biggest criticism of them? They don't message well. Duh, of course they don't message well. The right wing has it all over the Democrat side in messaging. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Brad. Appreciate that. What about the messaging thing? You know, Amina, that's an interesting point. I want to drill down into that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I'll just begin by saying that in terms of Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, or racism, no one party does it better necessarily. And so as a nonpartisan organization that tracks and makes sure that we address Islamophobia and anti-Muslim discrimination, you know, in terms of politicians, unfortunately, it's on both sides. I think it's not just about messaging, but it's about, I think, drawing a line. When we want to say that we want to stand up for human rights and injustices, sometimes we have to do it amongst our own, and we need to make sure that our the words that we use when we say that we stand up for these things are ones that aligns with our actions. And so if that may be in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, or even amongst our own faith communities, or amongst our neighbors, or if we belong to a particular institution, oftentimes what's happening is the breakdown of not stepping up. And that can look in different ways. Sometimes it doesn't have to be an intervention where we're putting ourselves in danger. But that's where advocacy comes in, right? That's where we mobilize a community. Say, for instance, if there's a person that is known to be, you know, speaks hateful rhetoric against a particular group, making sure that their event's canceled and mobilizing a community to make sure of that. You know, stepping up and speaking up, say, for instance, I know in the Muslim community, oftentimes building even a mosque or a community center is an uphill battle because zoning and permits are oftentimes very difficult to get. So it's stepping up and making sure that all of us as community members, when one community or one minority is the recipient of either hatred you know, a propagation of and pushback, that we make sure that we're all stepping up because that's part of our responsibility.
Mm. And to Amina's point, I think standing with brothers and sisters of different faiths in moments where they're experiencing challenge does not have to require everyone to agree about every single mm-hmm. item that they might think or believe. I dare say that there are things that Amina and I might disagree about, perhaps. And yet, here we are able to have a conversation about Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim rhetoric that exists in our community because it is a common cause. And I think that we look to our leaders of all kinds in this country, including our political leaders, to teach us how to bridge that gap and overcome that incredible divide that exists in our society in order to bring productive change. And so often it is impossible to even discuss things that you agree about because heaven forbid you should be the one that reached across the aisle.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to reach a compromise on everything, but it's okay to work together on things that you agree about to find productive solutions to problems. And that model has such an incredible power to show that hateful speech has no place in our society. And I would add one thing in terms of the idea of free speech, and I'm certainly no constitutional expert, but the fact that we have the right to speak also means that we have the right to not say something. And even if you have hateful feelings in your heart or in your mind, it doesn't mean that you have to express them out loud. You can take that adult step and say, I might have the right to speak, but I also have the right to keep my opinion to myself and let a person eat their meal in peace.
And speaking of political leaders, Jackie in Columbus, you're on the air. Jackie?
Hi there. I wanted to address Josh Mandel and his projection on his and rhetoric on his when he was trying to get elected.
Yeah.
And he really hit the point that Black Lives Matter was racist and hateful. And to me, that's a big dog whistle. There were dog whistles in other advertisements, and I want to kind of address that. Amina, I don't think that both parties do it the same. Tim Ryan, in some of his first presentations, said China about 7 times, but I think he got some feedback on that, and he changed. Although he did his last ones did say okay. China.
Well, but, Jackie, we're running out of time, so I want them to address that the role of the politicians. I mean, right? Josh Mandel says that Black Lives Matter is racist. There's other examples of kind of turning turning it on us.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So the reference, I think, is not necessarily specific to Ohio campaigns, but really looking at it more broadly, we talk about it may be the case that people are paying a little bit more attention, but there's explicit biases in rhetoric and there's also implicit. So I would say no one party monopolizes over that. And I think it's hard to be able to hear it when you are not of one minority. It's oftentimes inferred, but the implications are just as bad. I think with particular, and since we're talking about politicians and power and public office, is that, with power comes responsibility, and being a public servant requires that responsibility, and running for office as a candidate is should as well have that that value system of what our country stands up for should be what a person is thinking about as they're running for office, whether that be Mandel or otherwise. And unfortunately, in more recent years, while the bias may have been a little bit more implicit, we find that not only is it explicit, but that is oftentimes an opportunistic way to be able to gain followers and gain votes. And I know certainly we should not have that. I'd say election results have proven that is the case.
We have just about 15 seconds. Yeah.
Listen, I think at the end of the day, elections are decided by those who show up.
Absolutely.
So if you care about who your elected representatives are, get to your polling place. Make sure you vote.
There's power in that.
Words of wisdom. Hillel Skolnick, Senior Rabbi for Congregation Tifereth Israel, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Amina Barhoumi, Acting Executive Director of CARE Ohio, thanks for your time as always.
Of course.
And John Esposito, professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Delighted.
Thanks to everybody for listening. Don't forget to vote. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.